What little vegetation there had been along the banks of the ancient riverbed quickly fell behind them as they climbed the nearest slope, the loose rock and earth slipping beneath their feet with every step. The terrain evened out once they got to the top of the hill, which was a relief. They paused a moment to catch their breath. It had been a difficult climb, and they had both been worn out before they'd started. A glance back down the trail showed the two other SUVs slamming to a halt on the bank of the river. Seconds later, Porter and his two men poured out and began scrambling down the riverbank. One figure remained behind. Anya pulled Henry behind a nearby boulder.
How you doing?
Didn't think I was going to be running around the Kalahari when I left the house this morning. I'm all right, though. Yep, I'll be just fine.
Anya looked back down the trail again. Porter and his men had crossed the riverbed and were now headed toward the very slope that she and Henry had just climbed. 10, maybe 15 minutes at most, and they would catch up.
Listen to me, Henry. There's no way you're going to outrun them. Not after what you've already been through.
You're right. I'll stay here and delay them while you go on.
No. I mean, yes, I want us to split up, but not for that reason. Look, I've spent most of my adult life hiking in and out of canyons like this on various archaeological digs. I'm confident I can keep ahead of them long enough to lead them away from you and then throw them off my trail. While I'm doing that, I want you to hunker down somewhere safe. When they come after me, you can double back and do what you can to get to the vehicles below us. I don't think they left anyone guarding them.
How long should I wait for you?
I don't want you to wait. Run for civilization as fast as you can. I can take care of myself as long as it takes for you to come back with reinforcements.
Okay. I don't like it. Not one bit. But I'll do as you say.
As Henry hurried off down a path that looked like it would provide him with some shelter, Anya decided to give their pursuers a reason to come after her rather than him. She bent and quickly picked up a half a dozen rocks. Each was reasonably round and roughly the size of a racquetball. They were just large enough to cause some serious damage if they struck the right spot, but not so big that she couldn't throw them with accuracy. Aware that the rifleman might still be out there waiting for her, Anya peeked around the boulder. The former gunman was now climbing up the slope behind the rest of them.
Perfect.
When Anya was ready, she stepped out from behind the boulder, wound up, and threw the first rock. Her first throw had gone long and high. She'd been throwing from a height and had forgotten to factor in the slope of the trajectory. Anya gripped another rock loosely in her hand. The stone hit Porter right in the face.
That's for Tolo.
The third rock dropped one of the other men.
Bullseye.
Kill her!
Anya dove back behind the boulder just in time. They wouldn't take long to cover the remaining distance between them once the shooting stopped. The rock walls quickly rose around her as she ran deeper into the canyons. She fell into the rhythm of taking the right-hand path every time the opportunity presented itself, heading eastward with every turn.
Shouldn't take long to lose them.
Fifteen minutes later, Anya stopped for a quick breather. Behind her, the pursuit continued. No matter what she did, she just couldn't seem to shake them. After only a few moments of rest, she set off again, doing her best to stay close to the walls of the canyon where the shade was thickest and the cool air seemed to collect. Anya continued forward, moving, running, one foot in front of the other, over and over and over again. After a time, she reached a wide fork in the trail and slowed momentarily, thinking about her next move. The left path was wide, well lit from the sun high above, and relatively free of loose rockfall. The high rock walls and narrow canyons wreaked havoc with acoustics, but it still seemed to her that the others were getting even closer. She forced herself to go faster, knowing she wouldn't be able to keep up the pace for much longer, but equally aware that she would need to if she didn't lose them sooner rather than later.
If I can just get a big enough lead.
Anya charged around a corner and skidded to a halt. A few yards in front of her, the canyon ended in a sheer rock face that rose a good 20 or 30 feet above where she stood. She looked frantically about, hoping she missed some opening somewhere that she could try to squeeze through, but there was nothing. It was a dead end.
Come on!
Abruptly changing course once more, Anya rushed over to the wall that formed the canyon's end and began searching for hand and footholds that might carry her to the top. She grabbed another handhold and pulled herself fully onto the rock face, seeking and finding support for her feet, and then reaching for the next hold with her other hand. Suddenly, the rocky little spire she was standing on crumbled beneath her feet just as she reached for a new handhold. She scrambled against the rock, looking for something to stop her downward slide. The fall knocked the wind out of her, and for a few seconds, all she could do was lie there and fight to breathe. In the end, it was her fear of being caught that way by Porter and his men that got her back to her feet. A moment later, Bryant appeared at the entrance to the cul-de-sac with a 9mm pistol in his hands, aimed at Anya. Behind him came several other men. All were armed, some with pistols, some with automatic rifles. Malcolm Porter pushed his way to the front of the group.
Well, well, well. What have we here, boys?
With some satisfaction, Anya got a good look at the damage her stone had done to his face. Porter's eye was all but obscured by the swelling, and from the way it was already bluish black, Anya knew she'd at least broken his cheekbone.
Caught like a rat in a trap, Miss Creed.
Porter turned to Bryant.
Give me your knife.
Anya watched as the former commando turned over a wicked-looking combat knife. Porter began walking toward her, knife in hand. He was expecting her to be afraid and shrink from him. If he thought he could make her cower with that little pocket knife, he'd obviously forgotten their earlier encounter in the restaurant back in Maun. She was going to show him what a real blade looked like.
What's the matter? Cat got your tongue?
Take a couple more steps, lardass.
It's payback time.
Give it your best shot.
Porter took those final few steps to bring him into range. He held the knife up in front of him.
Say hello to my little friend.
Sure. Right after you meet mine.
Porter clapped a hand to the side of his face. Blood welled up over his fingers as he stared at the sword. Anya cut him again, across the chest from shoulder to shoulder. Porter danced backward out of reach.
What's the matter, Porter? Cat got your tongue?
Porter moved in. Anya kept her back to the wall, making it impossible for Porter to circle around and attack her from the rear. He rushed forward, but Anya was there with the sword, driving him back. He fainted and tried again. Anya slashed him across the outside of one arm. He suddenly stepped back.
Shoot her in the leg, Bryant!
With pleasure, sir.
Anya kept her eyes on Porter, mindful that he might be using Bryant as a distraction. She could see Bryant unsling the rifle from his shoulder out of the corner of one eye, and that was all she needed. She'd move when she saw the gun come up toward his shoulder. Any second now... Two of Porter's men suddenly collapsed, arrows jutting from their throats. A third shot, aimed at Bryant, struck the barrel of his gun. Another of Porter's men went down, and another arrow narrowly missed Porter himself. Anya released the sword and dropped into a crouch. Looking up, she saw that several tribal warriors stood silhouetted against the sky, bows drawn. As with the San back in the village, they wore little clothing, and their wrists and ankles were decorated with all manner of bracelets and charms. Unlike the people of the elephant, however, this particular group's jewelry appeared to be fashioned from gold and jewels. Bryant caught sight of the newcomers about the same time Anya did. The body of a San warrior suddenly slammed into the ground a few feet from Anya. Bryant began backing up toward the entrance of the rocky cul-de-sac as fast as possible. Anya was forgotten as the men turned their attention to this new threat. Two more tribesmen were hit and fell back out of sight. It should have helped Porter's team recover their confidence, but the unerring accuracy of the enemy's efforts far outmatched their own. With the exception of Bryant, few of them had faced a foe who fought back. When another of their number went down with an arrow in the thigh, the rest of Porter's men broke and ran. Seeing his head of security abandoning the field, along with the rest of his men, Porter glared at Anya one final time. He also turned and ran as fast as he could for the canyon mouth a few dozen yards away. Several arrows were fired in his direction, but by some miracle he wasn't hit. At the mouth of the canyon, Bryant waited for his employer to run past him, sent a few more covering shots toward the tribesmen on the ridge above, and then followed in Porter's wake. Anya stayed where she was for a moment, looking out at the aftermath of the confrontation. It took her a moment to realize that the injured were neither moving nor making any sounds. Anya glanced back up toward the ridge above her. Three of the tribal warriors remained, watching her like hawks, their bows at the ready. The rest had disappeared.
Headed this way, no doubt.
What happened when they got there was anyone's guess. She kept her hands in view and did her best to look disarming. The situation in front of her had her puzzled, however, and after a moment she couldn't resist her curiosity any longer. She cautiously made her way toward the nearest injured man, who had taken an arrow through the right calf. She could see the feathered end sticking up even now. The wound was by no means life-threatening. As Anya knelt beside him, she got her first look at his face. His eyes were open and unblinking in the sunlight, his features twisted in pain. An arrow to the calf had killed him.
Poison.
The San tribes used a kind of poison made from the larvae of a small beetle, but it was slow-acting and often required hunters to follow the injured animal for hours, sometimes days, before it succumbed. Whatever this stuff was, it worked much faster and with considerably more deadly results. It didn't take long for the rest of the warriors to descend from the ridge and enter the canyon. Anya rose from her crouch to face them. Two of them held their weapons trained on her, while a third bound her hands behind her back with a piece of rough rope.
Who are you, and where are you taking me?
The language was similar to the one she'd heard back in the village, and she was just as unable to understand it. He took her firmly by the arm and led her to the mouth of the cul-de-sac, where they waited for the other men to finish searching the bodies of the dead. Guns were ignored, but knives seemed to be highly prized. Each time one was found, it was held aloft and displayed to the others. The combat knife Porter had threatened her with was collected by one of the men and handed to her captor, giving Anya the sense that he might be the leader of the group. He was tall and well-built, which was easy to see given that he was wearing little more than a loincloth around his waist. He had thick, dark hair and brown eyes. His nose, broken at some time, had healed slightly out of place. His skin was deeply tanned, but Anya thought it was lighter than the people of the elephant.
We've traveled some distance from the people of the elephant, so it's logical to assume I've stumbled into some other group's territory. But who are they? And why did they attack Porter and his men? More to the point, what do they want with me?
The rest of the group had finished with the bodies of the dead and were now gathering around their leader. They headed off, taking Anya along with them. They left the dead-end canyon behind and followed a twisting trail that led deeper into the canyons and made it difficult for even Anya to keep track of. At first, she'd been surprised they hadn't blindfolded her or made any attempt to keep their path a secret, but gradually she came to realize they didn't need to. The complexity of the trail was barrier enough for anyone who attempted to follow. They walked for well over an hour, taking only one break. When they stopped, one of the men offered her a drink from a water skin. It was warm and tasted of old leather, but she drank greedily, not knowing when she might get the next chance. When she was finished, they set out once more, traveling up and down hills and through various intersecting ravines, until, after what seemed like hours, they entered what she thought to be another dead-end canyon. She realized it was something far different when they came to its end. A massive stone temple loomed out of the fading afternoon light. Like the ruins at Petra in Jordan, the front of the temple had been carved directly from the face of the rock, giving the impression that it was growing right out of the wall itself. Its age was immediately apparent, the wind and weather having dulled and rounded the carving's once sharp corners and fine lines. It was only when Anya got closer and could see the faded remains of the paintings that covered the front of the temple, representations of elephants and lions and men around a campfire, that she understood where she'd seen it before. Nearly identical paintings covered the interior walls of the temple in the elephant graveyard.
Clearly the two are connected, but how? And why?
Anya wanted to stop and study the symbols covering the stone to try to understand, but Bent Nose pushed her along in front of him, and bound as she was, she had no choice but to go along. Her disappointment soon turned to excitement, however, when she realized that they were headed inside the mysterious temple. Just beyond the doorway were four warriors. They were standing in the shadows, and Anya didn't realize they were there until they stepped out to greet Bentnose and his companions. The guards, what else could they be, were curious about her, but Bentnose seemed reluctant to talk and eventually moved her over to a table in the corner that held a stone bowl filled with pitch-soaked torches. Soon the room was filled with a warm, flickering glow. Bentnose stopped to confer with two of the men that had been guarding the entrance in unintelligible whispers, giving Anya a chance to look at the paintings decorating the walls. Unlike those on the outside, these had been protected from the elements and still retained much of their original gloss and color. The paintings ran along the wall at about chest height, and it only took a moment for Anya to understand they were telling a story, each panel leading into the next. The first few panels showed a peaceful people living in a small village on the banks of a great river. Wildlife was plentiful, it seemed, as there were many pictures of elephants and zebras mingling with the people, and in some of the pictures it seemed the two were working together. The village grew into a stone city in the next few panels, the mud and thatch houses replaced by multi-story buildings of stone. There were several depictions of the Elephant Temple, as she'd taken to calling the building where she had found Humphrey's final clue, and the animal itself seemed to play a role in daily life for these people. But then, the tone and tenor of the images changed to dead elephants and dead people. In each were what appeared to be another group, perhaps another local tribe, that were depicted as the cause of the suffering.
It looks like a neighboring tribe came in and began to kill the elephants, and the people of the city fought to protect them.
Then the last three images caught Anya's eye. The first showed the city on the plain, deserted and abandoned. Sticks littered the ground, which seemed odd to Anya, until she realized that they weren't sticks at all, but bones.
Elephant bones? Wait, the other temple. Is this how the elephant graveyard started? In the aftermath of a war? Is that temple all that's left of the city in these images?
The second to the last image showed a long line of people, refugees from the ruined city, stepping into a dark hole in the trunk of a massive baobab tree. In the final image, the tree stood alone. The hole in its trunk was gone, as were all the people. It was as if the tree had swallowed them whole.
The vanished tribe.
Anya tried to remember what she could about San religious beliefs and mythology.
I know they have two gods, or godlike beings, the one that lives in the east and the one that lives in the west.
Unfortunately, that was about the extent of her knowledge. The legend pictured on the wall in front of her might be an incredible find, something that hadn't been seen before. Then again, it might be common knowledge for any anthropologist who spent time in the field with the San. Not for the first time, Anya wished she could communicate directly with these people. She had so many questions she wanted to ask, and not being able to was driving her crazy. Things would have been a lot easier if Henry was still with her. Still, she was thankful they split up when they did.
I sure hope Henry got away.
Anya was so deeply lost in her thoughts that she didn't realize Bentnose had finished his conversation. He stepped between her and the wall, startling her.
Uno fanya nini? Haya sikwa ajili nino. Karudi na yuma.
He stepped toward her, shooing her back with his hands.
Kuja! Tutaena deleya!
The others held the torches high and moved deeper into the temple. They passed through several chambers, one after another, too quickly for Anya to get a good look around, though it was clear from the amount of dust that the building hadn't been used for its original purpose in a long time. When they reached the last chamber, Anya got her biggest shock of the afternoon. A stylized painting of a giant baobab tree covered the entire rear wall, its outstretched branches seeming to flicker and wave in the torchlight as if blown by wind. And in its center, just like in the earlier painting, loomed a gaping hole. As they drew closer, Anya realized that it was the opening to a cave. The same cave that had apparently swallowed an entire tribe of people. Without hesitation, Bentnose led Anya and the rest of the group to it. She felt her pulse kick up a notch as they stepped through the entrance. The torchlight splayed over the close walls, and she saw that it wasn't a cave at all, but rather a tunnel running deeper into the mountain. To Anya's experienced eye, it looked as if the passage had formed naturally, but had then been expanded by years of painstaking work. There were sections where the surface of the walls had been smoothed out, and she could even see the impact of hand tools on the rock itself. They followed the tunnel for what felt like another 15 minutes. It twisted and turned with easy regularity, and twice even doubled back on itself for several dozen yards. But in the end, it kept them moving down. The incline wasn't steep, just a few degrees, but it was steady. And after a time, Anya guessed that they had descended about 75, maybe 100 feet beneath the surface. No one spoke. The one time Anya started to ask a question, Bent Nose nudged her.
Shh.
At one point, they came around a bend. Anya started and glanced around, expecting a wall of water to come rushing down the narrow tunnel at them. But nothing happened. Curious, she stepped closer to the wall. A glance at the wall showed the stone literally sweating from the moisture that was running somewhere on the other side. Another decade or two was all it was going to take for the water to find a way through the barrier and into the tunnel they were now using. Eventually, the tunnel leveled out, and even began climbing slightly back up the way they had come. Not too long after that, daylight began to filter back down the tunnel toward them, and Anya guessed that they were nearing its end. Her suspicions were confirmed when they rounded a corner to see the opening at the other end of the tunnel, guarded by four more warriors. As they approached, the two groups greeted each other. Bent Nose and his party were obviously expected. Anya, however, was not, and the new tribesmen stared at her in astonishment.
I feel like a bug under a microscope. Haven't they seen outsiders before?
There was more than enough light, and those carrying torches doused them in a barrel of water set to one side, and then left them there. With a light step, Bent Nose led her toward the cave exit. Reaching it, she hesitated for a moment, letting her eyes adjust to the sunlight after being in the dark for so long. She stepped out on the edge in front of the cave mouth and stared down in wonder at the valley below and the city nestled within it.
The lost city of the Kalahari.
A city of stone sprawled out along the shore of a subterranean lake, complete with its own cascading waterfall. Red-orange sunlight poured in from the opening high above, striking the eastern side of the valley floor, leaving the west in shadow. And Anya knew that it would gradually stretch outward as the sun fell completely behind the rim above. She could see people on the streets below, tending to their business in the late afternoon sunlight. And here and there, Anya thought she saw a dog at their heels. As she gazed out at the incredible sight, she noticed two buildings set off by themselves near the summit of the waterfall. The first was a multi-story structure that reminded her of a palace, with its curving lines and sophisticated design, vastly superior to the block-like construction of the rest of the city's buildings. The second building rose like a beacon behind the first, a tall, slender cylinder that towered over everything else in the valley. From this distance, she couldn't tell if it was ornamental or some kind of functional construction, such as a watchtower.
Note to self, investigate both buildings when the opportunity arises. If the opportunity arises.
Anya pulled at her bindings to see if they had loosened at all during the trek. They had not. Bent Nose stepped up beside her and swept his arm across the view in front of them, taking in the entire city with a single motion.
Lana.
When Anya looked at him questioningly, he pointed at the city again.
Kasana.
Anya understood. The city's name was Kasana.
Kasana.
Bent Nose led her over to a wooden platform built into the side of the rock ledge, where sat a large basket constructed of tree branches woven together with rope-like vines. The makeshift gondola was big enough to carry 15 men, by Anya's estimate. Their party fit into it without difficulty. Nestled into an alcove in the cliff face behind the basket was a sophisticated wheel and pulley system that ran this primitive version of an elevator. When they were settled inside the gondola, Bent Nose grabbed a lever standing upright just outside the basket. In response, the large wooden spool in the alcove began turning, letting out the rope coiled around it, and the basket began descending at a slow, measured speed.
It'll take at least 10 minutes to reach the bottom at this rate. I wish we could go faster. I can't wait to see the city. I wonder if I'll find out what happened to Humphrey.
Anya wasn't the only one impatient to get down, apparently. Bent Nose abruptly turned to one of his men.
Ini kuchukua muda unwefe sana. Kupata chini ya hapo na tahadawi ya emzi kuhusu kuwasili yatu.
The warrior nodded and slung his bow over his shoulder. Anya nearly had a heart attack when he swung his legs over the outside edge and dropped over the side. She leaned over the edge of the basket and glanced down. The warrior was shinnying down the rope stretched out taut beneath the basket, making his way toward the ground below as fast as his hands and feet could carry him. At the rate he was going, he was likely to reach the bottom several minutes before they did.
What's so important that their leader has to send word ahead? Could it be my arrival?
The trip to the valley floor took closer to 20 minutes than 10, but at last, they touched down. They disembarked, with Anya in the middle of the group. They had come down in a clearing inside a grove of trees. The city itself was east of them, on top of a series of low rises, like a miniature Rome astride its seven hills. A well-marked and well-traveled footpath led through the woods toward the city. Anya assumed that was where they were headed. Before they got underway, however, Bentnose paused. He stared at Anya for a long moment, and then gestured for her to turn around so her back was to him. There was a sharp tug on her wrists, and then, to her surprise, her bonds fell away, leaving her hands free. Bentnose was just slipping a knife back into his belt when she turned to face him, rubbing the sore spots on her wrists where the rope had dug in. He shrugged before indicating with his hand that it was time to leave. As they stepped away from the basket, the lift's control mechanisms came into view. It was a large wooden wheel set horizontally on a wooden post, wrapped with a thick series of ropes. Four large beams extended from the wheel at each of the cardinal points of the compass. Turning the wheel clockwise by pushing against the beams would wind out the rope and lower the lift to the ground. Turning the wheel counterclockwise would do the opposite, winding up the rope and raising the lift to the ledge high above. It was simple, yet elegant. The leverage provided by the wheel and pulley system allowed the lift to be operated with only a few men, regardless of how many were in the basket. There were four operators standing near the wheel, but all of them were facing away from Anya. Something about their stance told Anya they were reluctant, as if they had been ordered to turn away. Anya glanced at Bentnose, but he didn't seem to notice, either her scrutiny nor the lift workers themselves.
Curious.
At a signal from Bentnose, the group started up the path toward the city. The warriors were much more at ease now, walking with their bows strapped over their backs and a lightness of step that told Anya they were not afraid of anything in the forest around them. For her part, Anya was amazed at the vibrancy and lushness of the foliage. To her, it felt as if the valley existed outside space and time, and it was easy to forget that just on the other side of the tunnels they'd passed through was one of the driest parts of Africa. She was amazed that this place had existed so long without being discovered by the outside world.
Of course, the warriors around me probably have something to do with that.
Emerging from the trees, Anya could see the city just ahead of them. They continued forward, leaving the path behind and making their way down a wide street she took to be a major thoroughfare. Most of the structures they passed were one- or two-story buildings, though she could see taller ones poking above the skyline. All the structures were constructed of rough-hewn stone blocks held together with some kind of dried mortar. Straw and mud, most likely. Both materials were plentiful and easy to repair. The buildings reminded her of the walls in Farini's turn-of-the-century photographs, though smaller and more refined. It was difficult to tell the age of them by looking. They seemed old, but there was a lot less wear than she expected, and it took her a moment to remember that the entire city was protected, in part, from the elements by its very location.
They could be hundreds, if not thousands of years old, and they would still fare far better than any structure out on the open plain.
They entered the city proper and began moving down a winding series of roads. Wherever Anya looked, she saw signs of an established, successful culture. The buildings were in good repair. The streets were clean. Bright color could be seen everywhere, from decorations and paintings on the buildings themselves to clothing hanging out to dry in the sun on balconies and terraces. Even the air, crisper and cooler, with more than a hint of humidity from the nearby lake, was clean and free of the smell of human presence that so often pervaded towns and villages throughout the Third World. One thing she didn't see anywhere was people. The streets around them were deserted. Now, Anya understood what the warrior Bent Nose had sent on ahead of them had been instructed to do. That he'd managed to clear the streets on his own in less than 15 minutes was astounding. It spoke of a highly regimented and highly organized society.
Considering my current situation, I'm not sure that's a good thing.
They made several turns, traveling into the center of the city. Once, Anya saw someone peeking out at her from behind partially open shutters, quickly disappearing at a glance from Bent Nose. Eventually, they found themselves at the foot of another hill that held a single building, the palace-looking structure she had seen from the ledge above. Bent Nose headed toward it without a word.
Seems like I'm gonna meet whoever's in charge here.
A phalanx of guards lined the steps leading to the building's entrance, spears and bows ready. As they drew closer, Bent Nose placed a hand on Anya's arm, indicating that she should hang back with the others while he stepped out ahead to meet with the leader of the guards. Anya watched as the two men conferred in unintelligible whispers for a few minutes. It was clear that the captain of the guard, a tall, muscular fellow who looked more than capable of handling himself in a tight spot, was upset about something to do with her. He showed considerable deference to Bent Nose, however, which raised the other man's standing in Anya's eyes and caused her to wonder if he were more than just your average scout party leader.
A minor noble, maybe? The son of an elder?
Whatever the case, the two men apparently came to a compromise. Bent Nose returned to Anya's side, the captain in tow, and the two of them took up position on either side of her. Bent Nose then turned to Anya, taking a firm grip on her arm just above the elbow. He nodded to the captain, who quickly did the same. Satisfied that their prisoner was now in their control, the two men started up the stairs to the palace, bringing Anya along with them. Behind them, a pair of palace guards followed suit, while the rest of the existing guard, plus Bent Nose's men, remained where they were. Her captors led her inside, down several corridors, until at last they came to a stop before a set of double doors guarded by a pair of men. The guards opened the doors and ushered them inside. It was an audience chamber. That much was obvious from the dais with the throne sitting on it. The throne was extraordinary. It appeared to be fashioned from the largest elephant skull Anya had ever seen. The skull had been turned upside down, so the crown rested on the floor, and the skull cavity itself converted into a seat. In that position, the tusks curved downward at an angle, creating a paired set of armrests. Long, curved bones, ribs maybe, had been attached to the back of the throne like the feathers on a peacock's tail, giving it a wingback appearance. But what riveted her attention was the oversized diamond set into the wall just above the throne. It had to be a foot across and must have weighed 100 pounds. Even though it was rough and uncut, Anya recognized it for what it was immediately and knew that in its present state it would be worth tens of thousands of dollars on the open market. If it were to be cut and polished, that figure would grow exponentially. Two concentric circles of symbols had been painted around it, and Anya was yet again reminded of the icons surrounding the Mayan calendar.
Is this a calendar too?
Two men walked out of the shadows on the left side of the dais and crossed toward the throne. The first man was old, with a face so wrinkled that it seemed to swallow his features. He was dressed in a colorful sarong that left his chest and arms bare, just like his feet. He crossed the dais, climbed into the skull throne, and looked at her with interest. The man accompanying him was much larger, a few inches over 6 feet, and wore a bright robe that covered him from head to foot. The hood on the robe was pulled up, hiding his face completely. He took a few steps down the front of the dais and then stopped, standing between the two groups.
Mimi ni Latu.
I am Lato, elder and tribal chief of the people. Why are you here? What do you want?
Myself and my companion were being held against our will by evil men. We managed to escape and sought refuge in the mountains, where your people found us.
Where is this companion now?
I do not know. We were separated before your people arrived.
Je, mwanamke kuseme kweli?
Ndio yeye hana.
The elder turned to Bentnose and had a brief conversation. The translator did not share what was said, so Anya didn't know exactly, but she had a hunch the elder was asking if what she was saying was true. After consulting with his subordinate, the elder turned to her once more.
Ebu yakia, kuendelea.
Nagamush says that you were surrounded by enemies when the people found you, and yet, regardless of the odds, you were prepared to fight. Like a lioness protecting her cubs. When the people captured you, you did not fight back. He is confused by this.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend, eldest. Until they took me prisoner against my will, the people had not given me reason to consider them anything but a friend.
Anasema adui wa adui, yake ni rafiki yake. Mpaka sisi alichukua, mfunga wake dehidi ya mapenzi yake. Watu hakuwapa, sabubu yake kufikiria ya chochote lakini rafiki.
The elder pursed his lips, clearly not happy with her translated answer.
Wewe waliva mia ineo yetu, na silaha katika mekono yako. Je unafikiri watu engekuwa tu basi kwamba kupita?
You invaded our territory with weapons in your hands. Did you think the people would simply let that pass?
I did not enter your territory with a weapon, nor did I have one in hand when the people took me prisoner.
Anasema yeye hakuwa na kuinjia inchi yetu na silaha wala. Yeye kuwamaja takita mkono wakati watu alichukua mfungwa wake.
The elder signaled an end to the discussion with a sharp slash of his hand, silencing the translator.
Knowledge of the people has been forbidden to outsiders since our passage through the hole in the world. We have jealously guarded our city and will continue until the twin gods decide the end has come. Yet, according to Nagamush, you have not raised your hand in anger against the people, so I am loath to pass judgment. Death does not seem just. You shall remain with us until I have had sufficient time to eat, drink, and pray.
So I'm to be a prisoner then?
Think of yourself as an honored guest. Nagamush will see to your needs.
Now wait a minute, there's no way—
You want I carry out the first sentence instead?
No.
With that, the wizened old man rose and walked back across the dais, the translator at his heels. They retraced their steps to the door through which they'd entered and disappeared inside. Anya turned to find Nagamush and the captain of the guards waiting for her. They led Anya back outside and turned her over to a squad of warriors, who in turn took her to a small house on the outskirts of the city. They ushered Anya into a bedroom at the back of the house. The door closed behind her. She was locked in. The room was rectangular and about the size of a studio apartment back in Brooklyn. It had one entrance, the door she'd just come through, and a single window. A quick check of the window revealed that bars covered it on the outside. The room was also lightly furnished, with just a bed and a table with two chairs of carved wood. A clay chamber pot stood in the far corner.
Now what?
She sat on the edge of the bed, suddenly exhausted. It had been a long and difficult day, and she'd had very little to eat.
In fact, now that I think about it, I haven't had anything at all since getting up this morning.
Anya came to her feet, hands loose and at the ready. Thoughts of escape vanished as the door opened and her two guards entered the room, followed by Nagamush. In his hands was a tray full of food and a jug.
Eat.
Surprised by his effort to speak her language, Anya smiled at him and received a smile in return.
Perhaps there's a potential ally in the making.
The three men stepped back outside the door, which was then closed and barred behind them. Anya barely noticed. All she had eyes for was the food. The tray held several different fruits and a bowl of some kind of meaty stew. A wooden spoon had been included as well. In the jug, she found water, just as she'd suspected. Anya didn't waste any more time. She dug in with enthusiasm. After a few bites, she decided the meat was some kind of antelope, chewy and with a distinct but not unpleasant gaminess that reminded her of venison or reindeer. She ate most of it, but set aside some of the fruit for later. She was going to need it for the energy required when she made her break for freedom later that night. When she was finished, she settled onto the bed. She was asleep within seconds. Anya awoke several hours later. Moonlight streamed in through the window. She rose to her feet, stretched, and then walked over to the window. The streets outside were deserted, and the town itself was quiet. She tiptoed to the door and put her ear against it, listening carefully. At least one guard had obviously dozed off. She leaned back and examined the door. While it was well built, there was a quarter-inch wide crack separating the edge of the door from the door jamb.
No better time than the present.
Stepping back, Anya reached out. Without hesitation, she slid the blade into the crack, pushed it forward a few inches, and then drew it slowly upward until she felt it hit the wooden bar placed across the door to secure it. It was clear the guards weren't paying attention, which meant Anya would have the advantage of surprise once she got the door open. She slid the sword up a good couple of feet. She felt the bar slide up with the sword and then tip out of its metal brackets. Anya burst through the door with her sword up and startled the guard, who was staring wide-eyed at the crossbeam now lying at his feet. Flat of her sword caught him across the side of the head and he went down. The sleeping guard had been startled awake by the noise and was just now sitting upright on the floor mat he'd been using as a bed. He was so stunned by the disappearance of the sword that he never saw the right hook coming. Anya caught him and lowered him to the floor. She crouched next to him for a moment, listening, waiting for sounds of alarm from elsewhere in the building. She didn't hear anything.
Time to get out of here.
With her sword out before her in the ready position, she crept to the end of the hall and peered around the corner. The hallway was empty. So was the one after that. She made it all the way down the staircase to the first floor and over to the front entrance. Anya glanced back up the stairs, searching for pursuit, as she stepped through the beaded curtain that covered the front entrance. She slammed into a woman carrying water. The woman took one look at the sword.
No, no,
she raced down the street, headed, she hoped, toward the edge of the city and the exit back to the world above. Anya pushed herself to run faster. The streets were narrow and the buildings loomed close, preventing her from getting a good sense of where she was. The road curved to the right, and as she came out of the turn, she spotted a search party coming, the lights of their torches bobbing in the darkness. Anya skidded to a stop, glancing left and right, looking for another route.
What on earth?
She'd passed the entrance to another street a few yards behind her on the left, and she turned that way. She didn't want to wait around to see what made a noise like that. Once off the main thoroughfare, the area became a tangle of interconnecting streets and alleyways that seemed to twist and turn at random. Within minutes, she was completely lost. At the next intersection, she came to a halt, trying to figure out where she was and what direction she should take. Everything looked familiar and alien at the same time.
Have I been down this road? What about that one?
Something raced out of the darkness to her right, and Anya spun in that direction. Her sword flashed out, catching it in mid-leap and cutting it in two with a single powerful blow. Blood splattered across the front of her face and shirt. She had a glimpse of fur and teeth. Then she was rushing on again, trying to find some way out of what was rapidly becoming a maze of streets and alleys. She was forced to change direction again. She turned left at the next corner, entering a narrow street with no doors on either side, but the road sloped downward here, and she began to hope that she was headed the right way at last. The hair on the back of her neck stood on end. Anya dashed down another street, turned left at the next intersection, and raced down that road as well. She ran around a wide curve and skidded to a halt. Before her was a dead end formed by the backs of the buildings in front of her. Anya ran over to the nearest building and put her back to it, striking a defensive stance with her sword up. Whatever it was going to have to come through the sword to reach her. Something moved in the shadows of the alley she'd just vacated, but she couldn't quite see what it was.
Come on now, show yourself.
Anya recognized it immediately. You couldn't spend time in Africa and not encounter a hyena.
Come on, then!
She was trying to get the leader to charge before others joined in.
I can whittle them down one at a time.
But the hyenas didn't move. They stood their ground, but made no move to come any closer. That's when Anya noticed the collar on the lead animal's neck.
Trained hyenas?
Several tribesmen, holding torches and weapons, appeared behind the animals. Anya gripped her sword tightly, determined to give a good accounting of herself in the fight to come. A sudden sting in Anya's left arm was all the warning she had. She looked down to find the end of a small dart sticking out of her forearm.
Uh-oh.
She took two steps forward as the world began spinning, and she fell. Anya came awake with a jolt. She sat up from the pile of blankets on the floor, glancing around at the unfamiliar room. Unlike the first room, this one was round. Aside from the pile of blankets, the only other thing in the room was a chamber pot. A chamber pot that looked suspiciously like the one she'd been given earlier.
How nice of them.
This room had three windows, but the same wooden bars covered them. She rose to her feet and walked, a little unsteadily, over to one of the windows and looked out. Two stories below, she could see the roof of the palace, and beyond that, the rest of the city. It looked from this height like some miniature model. It didn't take a genius to figure out that she was in the tall circular tower she'd seen upon first entering the city. Anya took a few steps toward the room's only door, but before she could get to it, the door swung open and a man entered. She recognized him immediately by the long hooded robe he wore. It was the Elder's translator. He stepped inside and closed the door behind him, but not before Anya caught sight of the four armed guards standing in the hallway outside.
Someone has learned their lesson, apparently.
Anya stared at the translator. The translator stared back.
Are you all right? Any dizziness? Nausea?
No. A foul taste in my mouth, but that's all.
They haven't given you any water? Or food?
No.
My apologies.
He turned and rapped once on the door, which was immediately opened from the other side.
Kupatihi'i! Umwanamke ba'adihiya! Chakula namaji! Sasa!
One of the guards hurried off to do his bidding.
Looks like the translator has some authority of his own.
Satisfied, he closed the door and faced her again.
I'm sorry for the... What the hell with this nonsense?
He reached up to push back his hood.
There. Much better, yes?
He was thinner than in his photographs and had shaved his head bald, but there was no mistaking him. It was the missing man himself, Robert Humphrey.
I thought you were dead!
There's been a time or two when I thought the same, but thankfully that sad day has not yet come to pass. Have we met?
No, sorry.
Anya stepped toward him, extending her hand.
Anya Creed, archaeologist.
Robert Humphrey.
Anya spun him around and got him in a chokehold.
Enough of this nonsense is right. What the hell is going on here, and why am I being kept prisoner?
Anya yanked once hard on his neck to show him she meant business. Humphrey made no move to try to escape.
Please, Miss Creed, I mean you no harm, and am here to try to help you. If the guards come back with the food and find us like this...
You want to help? Get me out of here, then.
I'm trying to do just that. Please, just hear me out. Quickly, before it's too late.
You had better be telling the truth.
Humphrey took a few steps away and put his hands on his knees, taking a moment to catch his breath. He opened his mouth to say something, but before he could, the door opened and a guard entered, carrying a bowl of fruit and a pitcher of water. Humphrey pointed to the floor, waited for the guard to put his burden down, and then waved him back out.
Seems you are a rather resourceful woman, Miss Creed. First, you break out of a locked room and disable the armed guard standing watch. And then you overpower a man twice your size and take him captive. Is that what they're teaching archaeologists these days?
A woman's gotta protect herself.
Humphrey watched her carefully for a moment. Anya was doing the same in return. He didn't appear to be a prisoner.
What are you really doing here, Miss Creed?
Looking for you.
Anya explained that she had acquired the Farini painting at his estate auction, about her confrontation with his son, Malcolm Porter, and of how Malcolm's botched theft had led her to discovering the puzzle Humphrey had left behind. Of course, at that point, she explained, she had no choice but to see it through to the end. The legend of the lost city of the Kalahari was just too amazing for the archaeologist in her to ignore, and the mystery of his disappearance made an excellent topic for a Chasing History's Monsters episode.
It was tailor-made for me.
Humphrey walked over to the window and stared out into the afternoon sunlight. He didn't say anything for a long moment. When he addressed her again, he didn't look at her.
So you're going to share the story of the show with the whole world?
The show?
Humphrey faced her, surprised, it seemed, that she wasn't familiar with the word. He waved vaguely at the window.
The show. Ancestors of the San, cousins to the Khoikhoi. Inhabitants of this beautiful city.
How did they end up here, in this remote place?
Same old story. Human greed. Once the show lived in peace, out on the plains, in harmony with life around them, in a city far larger than this one.
Anya flashed back to the mural she'd seen earlier, and to the ruins of the temple that had become the legendary elephant graveyard.
Evidence of that earlier city?
The show claimed that far in the distant past, the twin gods smiled on the people. To show their favor, they pulled a star out of the heavens and sent it down to their children here on Earth. The people discovered where the star had fallen and took it from the impact crater. They built a city on that spot, and for years they lived in peace. The Heartstone, as they came to call it, provided them with all they needed. But, like everything else, even the glory days of the show had to come to an end. Neighboring tribes envied them. They wanted the Heartstone for themselves, believing that if they had it, the favor of the twin gods would shine on them as well. The show's fate was sealed the day they let the word of the Heartstone leak beyond their walls.
What happened?
War happened, of course. The show were invaded by another tribe to the east.
Again, the image of the mural rose in Anya's mind. The pictures of the invading tribe, the dead filling the streets as the city fell around them.
And was the Heartstone lost?
Lost? Oh, heavens no. The shamans knew of the attack long before it occurred, warned, some say, by the Heartstone itself. They were able to evacuate the city before the invading horde arrived, leaving only a small force behind to delay pursuit as long as possible. The rest of the show fled into the mountains, this valley, and rebuilt their shining city. They've been here ever since.
And the Heartstone? Where is it now?
The same place it's always been, my dear. You've seen it yourself.
I have?
They say the Heartstone whispers its wisdom right into the Elder's ear. And that's one reason his decisions are so respected. Whatever he says goes. The people believe the twin gods are speaking directly to him through the Heartstone.
The diamond! In the audience chamber!
Quite right, my dear. Quite right.
The pieces of the puzzle snapped into place. With Humphrey's tale of the Heartstone, Anya finally understood just what Porter really wanted from the Lost City.
For a prize like that, Malcolm isn't likely to give up easily. These people are in serious trouble. We don't have much time. We have to warn them.
Warn who about what?
The show. About your son.
Malcolm? What does that overstuffed weasel have to do with this?
Anya already knew there was no love lost between the two men, so she filled him in on the rest of what Porter had done, from taking Henry Crane hostage to trying to kill them both in the canyons outside the city gates.
Malcolm tried to kill you and Henry?
He wants the treasure and he'll stop at nothing to get it.
Treasure? What treasure? The show aren't the Incas. They don't have gold or precious jewels lying around everywhere for the taking.
No, but they do have the Heartstone.
Oh no, he can't have that. No way.
I hardly think he's going to listen to you.
You don't understand, Anya. The Heartstone is a sacred religious object for these people. They will die to keep it safe.
Well, your son is going to find this place sooner rather than later, and he's going to come in here with guns and an attitude, looking to recoup some of the fortune you denied him in your will.
Humphrey started pacing back and forth, and for a minute, Anya thought he might work himself right into a heart attack. Humphrey opened the door to find a show warrior standing there. Humphrey and the warrior stepped back into the hall for a few moments, and then Humphrey re-entered the room.
The Elder has made his decision about you. He requests our presence immediately.